Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hi there, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast, which is a vessel for tactical, analytical football discussion with ideas and opinion from the Athletic's Tom Warville and Michael Cox. But confusingly, it's me, Ali Maxwell, who is the Cox of this particular vessel. Tom and Michael will be rhythmically rowing us downstream each week this season. You've both been really busy to kick off the campaign. Michael, I mean, it's a piece a day at the moment, or maybe a piece every other day. A busy man. Last week, you wrote a brilliant piece with Alan Shearer and Nedim Onuoha, which was titled "Interchanging Front Threes or a Traditional Number Nine: Why Top Premier League Teams Prefer Flexibility." Now, it absolutely sounds like the sort of thing we could flesh out into a podcast topic. That's not what we're talking about today. But out of interest, how do those collaborative pieces work for you? How did you go about that with the idea and the execution of that article with Shearer and Onuoha?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, Shearer, as people might know, is one of our columnists, has done some really good interviews on the site. And Nedim, who I don't know if people have heard him as a pundit on Five Live or I think BT a couple of times, but he's actually joined us as an editorial consultant, I think his title is. I'm not sure what that means from the perspective of editing, I must be honest, but I met him a couple of weeks ago and he's just incredibly good at analysing football, you know, has a really brilliant memory of games, and he's one of those players who, when he explains certain situations on a pitch, you almost feel like you're on the pitch and you can, you know, he runs through the decisions you're making. So, yeah, it was particularly interesting to talk to him about how you play against a side without a forward. And obviously there's certain things that, you know, we can see for ourselves, the fact you're not against anyone and the fact that you've got to be careful not to push up too much. But I think he was interesting on a kind of physical and psychological level about how you play against no striker, because he was saying that, you know, you almost go through games, you feel like you're not really involved. You know, you want to kind of impose yourself. You want to feel like you're on top in your battle and you just can't do that. And, you know, there's almost a temptation to just make challenges for the sake of it, to get yourself involved. And just little things like that. It's always interesting to speak to former players, especially ones that are so, you know, insightful as he is.
And just in terms of the tricks of the trade, and feel free not to give too much away, but of course, your piece with Gary Lineker last year about goal scoring was just so memorable. And, you know, we love reading your pieces that you do solo as well. But how do you approach it when you've got someone to talk to? Is it an interview style when you chat with them? Do you come with clips or with images to show them? Or do you speak to them first and see how it develops and then flesh out the piece?
I mean, there weren't really any clips involved in this one. Just, you know, it was just a general chat, really. But, yeah, I mean, I don't really interview people much. I kind of save myself. Lineker, Shearer, Onuoha. You know, it's only people who really got big opinions, I suppose. But I always think with footballers, they like to speak about the things that they did. You know, it's a really obvious thing to say, but if you've got the classic example is a striker. You know, I've done an article with Shearer, I think, about January, about movement in the box. And he's just brilliant in that situation because he is statistically the best ever Premier League goal scorer. And the stuff about movement and making runs, I just think, is always really interesting to listen to. But not everyone can be really insightful in every area. And I think you see that on Sky on Match of the Day. If you get a defender talking about playing left wing, they don't always really have that much insight. But obviously, to get to the top, you need incredible specialism in certain areas. So yeah, when you can speak to people who can give you perspectives you can't really imagine, it's always useful.
Yeah, worth a read, that piece. And Tom Warville, yours on Monday morning just happened to be a piece on set piece coaches in the Premier League. Now, that came out very fresh and hot on Monday morning after it had become something of a hot topic over the weekend after various bits and bobs of discussion in the more mainstream media. Was that well planned on your part or sheer coincidence?
I'd like to say it was well planned. Obviously you can't forecast certain pundits saying certain things about the topic, but it obviously helps. But it's something that I've kind of been keeping track of over the summer, of obviously ingoings and outgoings on the player front, but also on the coaching front as well, and kind of saw this trend of more set piece coaches, especially for Man United and recently Aston Villa as well. I kind of went into the weekend thinking that was going to be kind of my piece for Monday, kind of managed to ride the wave a little bit. So it was good timing, if anything.
The whole discussion about specialist coaches, I sort of confused me ever so slightly, because I felt like that was a discussion from about 2 years ago. I thought we'd got past that. But anyway, I don't think that's one for us necessarily to dig into too much, partly because I think we probably all have the same opinion, and that's pretty boring to listen to. Now, let's get into this week's topic. Michael, your weekend remit for the site was to break down Arsenal against Chelsea. It's a brilliant match review piece, but this week you've got right backs on your mind.
Yeah, I was trying to find a theme from the weekend, and you know, obviously early season, you think which players are doing interesting things tactically, and two of the ones who jumped out at me were right backs. And very established right backs, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Kyle Walker, and not necessarily doing things they haven't done before, but maybe doing it in a particularly notable way. And I thought that would make a good pod topic as well, because there's so much strength and depth throughout the Premier League. It's arguably the position that I think is the strongest in terms of, you know, if you were looking for a player who could theoretically play right back for Liverpool, I think you've probably got 10, 12 across the Premier League. Certainly you have the potential to do that. I think we're going to have a good discussion about that.
And with so many of our discussions, a starting point is to talk about the linguistics of football and the development of the words that we use to talk about positions and players and roles. Because when we talk about fullbacks, and you've touched on this before, but if I could ask you again, this is quite a good starting point to work out how much the game has evolved and how many different things players in positions are being asked to do than even 10, 20 years ago, let alone longer.
Yeah, I did think when looking at how Alexander-Arnold was playing, you know, he's a right back. He wasn't back, and he wasn't really on the right for a lot of it. So, you know, we talk about these positions a lot, and I think it's interesting as well, like, they're obviously, that's quite a very English word. Usually in kind of Spanish, Portuguese-speaking countries, their word for fullback involves the word lateral, various pronunciations according to where you are, but that implies width. And again, I mean, neither Alexander-Arnold nor Kyle Walker really were overlapping. And so, you know, we take it for granted now, I think, when you see Alexander-Arnold playing like that. But, I mean, it's very rare. I always think of right-back as probably the least glamorous position on the pitch. I mean, there's a famous quote from Gianluca Vialli going back probably 10, 20 years, where he says generally the right-back is the most limited player in the team, because if they were a great defender, they'd be a centre-back. If they were more creative, they'd be further forward. Whereas the left-back tends to be a bit more, there's a bit more flair there, I think. There's usually a bit more attacking intent. And I don't know whether that's still true, but I think the most notable side that fits that in recent years is the Italy side at the Euros that, of course, Gianluca Vialli was an assistant manager with, because Di Lorenzo, solid defender, but I would say unquestionably the 11th best player in that Italy team.
Yeah, so let's run through a few Premier League right-backs, and in doing so, I think we're going to discover that with such tactical diversity nowadays, I think we'll see how many different roles within that position are being asked of these guys. Tom, when we were chatting about this in the last few days, you brought up an increase in teams using what you described as asymmetrical roles at fullback, and with any phrase like that, I'd like you to explain a little bit more about what you mean.
Yeah, I guess that term really is just looking at, in a team, the right back and left back do different things. The right back can be more attacking and more defensive. They could come inside more with the left back staying out wide. And I think that's probably a bit of a departure to what we've seen in Premier Leagues, the Premier League in seasons gone by, where players are very much kind of mirror images of themselves, and they're not really that tactically different. And yeah, I guess we're just seeing more of that in the league this year, perhaps. Obviously, we're only two games in, but there's some notable ones, which obviously Michael has mentioned there, and we'll get into. But for me, one of the more striking and probably the best way of explaining it examples is Cesar Azpilicueta and Marcos Alonso under Antonio Conte a few years ago. Now, Conte obviously is someone who's always kind of favoured this three at the back with wing-backs approach, and that was a very clear one in the Premier League that was very, very effective. At the Euros this year, obviously, Michael's mentioned Italy there. I think we saw Denzel Dumfries on the right-hand side for the Netherlands being extremely attacking, with Patrick Van Aanholt being a bit less so on the other side. And then maybe slightly differently, but England with Luke Shaw, obviously charging forward and being very attacking on the left. And if Kieran Trippier or, you know, whoever's on the right-hand side being a bit more limited, a bit more conservative in their actions. So really kind of just some sort of asymmetry between the right and the left side, whether that's in attacking, positioning, anything like that. That's really what we're talking about here.
And Michael, when you have asymmetric roles at fullback, it has a knock-on impact on all of the roles as you move up the pitch, most specifically central midfield roles. Depending on what one of the fullbacks is doing, the central midfielder on that side may be asked to drop in or may be asked to run high and wide to essentially fill space, right? And then that has a knock-on effect on the wide players or the forward players and what sort of spaces they might occupy. I guess this is increasingly why, when talking tactics, we find it necessary to say things like a team is playing 3-5-2 out of possession, but 4-4-2 in it.
Yeah, I think we've certainly seen that more in the last few years. And I think one of the key patterns in big games recently has been kind of rotations down the flanks. I think some of the best sides, or the big overachieving sides in Europe in recent years, have done that very well. Certainly Ajax, Atalanta, I still think are maybe the most interesting side to watch every week. Napoli under Sarri, I remember, very good at that as well. So, yeah, you do get these little patterns where you've got groups of three or four players, in Atalanta's case, just almost like spinning triangles or spinning diamonds. And the shape that you end up in being equal is very important in terms of pressing as well. You know, you can't just have players going where they want and leaving gaps for the opposition to break into. So it's quite a good way of providing unpredictable movement while not losing your shape entirely.
I do wonder if an onus on improving sort of wide combination play might have been a knock-on effect of the sort of first 5 years of the 2010s, where defensively we saw teams have so much success. Atletico Madrid, always the one that spring to mind, just by denying any sort of space and progression in central areas, defending so narrow and inviting you to send crosses in. And if you score a header from a cross, then fair play. But we think you probably won't be able to do that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think football's changed quite a lot in that sense. I mean, I remember when I first started, you know, writing analysis around 2010, there was such a big emphasis on, particularly on Barcelona and Spain, kind of getting an advantage in midfield and putting an extra midfielder or an extra man in that zone and controlling the game there. But it feels like teams are just so solid and so compact in those positions that actually it's really about progression down the flanks is really where big games are won and lost these days. And I think it's someone like David Moyes, actually, who was almost always doing that. I mean, at Everton, it was all about, you know, Baines and Pienaar, you think of in particular down the left, but the same down the right with Coleman. And actually that style of football, I think, has slightly been repopularised. Whether that is related to Moyes' resurgence at West Ham, I don't know. But yeah, certainly there are different things that I'm looking for when I'm analysing matches these days.
Well, your big piece after the weekend was analysis of Arsenal 0, Chelsea 2. The piece is titled How Chelsea Used Their Shape to Tear Arsenal Apart. And of course, this leads us to perhaps the most eye-catching right-back or right-wing-back performance this weekend, arguably of the season so far, albeit only two games. And that was Reece James of Chelsea, who, well, he bagged a goal, an assist, and Tom, as Tom told me, and I'm stealing his stat, 9 touches in the penalty area, with his previous highest in the league for Chelsea being just 4. So he was a real standout this weekend, and that was, well, hard for you to ignore here.
Yeah, it was one of those games where, you know, if anything, Clive, the tactical battle was a bit too obvious, because I think anyone watching the game would have seen that James has just done marks, and everyone would have realised why it was. It was just the classic wing-backs pushing forward to create a front five, overloading a back four. We've seen it so much from Chelsea various guises over the last 5 years. We spoke about it on this podcast, certainly at the Euros when Portugal were battered really by Germany. I think all four of Germany's goals came from that route with Gossens and Kimmich at the far post, always creating overloads. But Chelsea did other things, you know, very effectively as well. I think they stretched the play in another sense by dragging Arsenal's midfield up and then playing through it really well. I think Kovacic was excellent. Didn't really hear much praise for him, but so many of Chelsea's attacks were prompted by his passes through the lines. He was very good at playing direct balls into Lukaku, who was a big factor as well. And Chelsea just so good at creating space. And I think that's obvious in various ways. They create space on the outside. They create space between the lines. I think in Mount and Havertz, they've got two players who are as good as you will find in European football. Just the concept of finding space in those pockets. Mount's brilliant at it. Havertz, I must say, I struggled to work out what he was all about for much of last season. He had a difficult first season in English football for various reasons. Had a particularly bad bout of COVID as well. But I thought, you know, Germany struggled at the Euros, but he was often excellent in the way that he found pockets of space, even that game against England that obviously Germany lost. But yeah, I think they're going to be a real force this season, Chelsea. I know it's an obvious thing to say because they're European champions, but as I said last week, I was a bit surprised they weren't ranked as favourites to win the Premier League because I just can't see a weakness in that side.
Mm. Pretty much the dream outing for a right back or a right wing back, wasn't it, Tom? I mean, you just pretty much know that as long as the game plan that your side has that works against the opposition, you're going to have so many opportunities to impact the game in the final third and much fewer opportunities to, or much fewer responsibility when it comes to the defensive side of the game. My question to you, Tom, is if Chelsea are going to be a title challenger playing like they have in the first few weeks of the season, could we see Reece James potentially benefit to the tune of reaching Trent Alexander-Arnold like numbers of goals and assists? I mean, 4 goals, 13 assists was Alexander-Arnold's record in 2019-20. Do you think James could get up towards that?
I think it's a really interesting question because we'd never really probably expect him to put up numbers like that before, and I've thought about it kind of long and hard since the weekend and just feel that it's probably that, you know, him being so attacking and almost like, I mean, he had ridiculous amounts of space at times against Arsenal. I think that's more a factor about the naivety of Arsenal and Arteta versus Reece James just being an outstanding attacking fullback. Now, I don't think that he's not. I just think that he's made to look even better by Kieran Tierney giving him loads of space, Bukayo Saka not getting back, and in general him just having the run of the park on that right-hand side. So I think that, you know, Trent's delivery on set pieces is better. More of the play goes through him. Liverpool work it well enough such that you know, their game plan is very much built around using him a lot, whereas with Chelsea they have other outlets and other means of attacking. Then again, if he can keep it up, I don't think he gets Trent-like numbers. I think he can get a good, you know, decent number of goals and assists this season. And then really it's the question of, is he the most versatile player in the Premier League at the highest level? You know, he can play right centre-back, right back, right wing-back. He can probably play centre-mid. I just think he has a very, very good tactical brain on him. His technical ability is fantastic. Physically, he's great. Like, what are the weaknesses of Reece James, really? And yeah, he set up from that performance for a very good season.
I also noticed something from Reece James, which I'm going to say now in case it makes me look quite smart over the next few weeks. And that was, again, maybe not a traditional type of movement when the ball was being played down the left side and delivered from the left side, rather than attacking the far post in a way that you might expect a right wing back to do, certainly against a back four where you could easily see there being that free man at the back post, that right wing back. James was actually tucking in normally towards the top of the D, very central, and actually received a few cutbacks from Alonso or from whoever was in possession down the left-hand side, which again looks like a clear instruction not to attack the back post, but actually to try and drag players out of position or be completely free because no one knows who to pick you up. And we know from that goal against Brighton last season that he can be a great threat in shooting from outside the box as well. So that's something to look out for over the next few weeks, a little wrinkle from Chelsea in possession. Let's talk about Trent Alexander-Arnold, Michael, because, you know, not as eye-catching a performance in terms of goals and assists so far this season, but a slight tweak to his role in build-up and in attack for Liverpool, certainly compared to the Trent that we saw burst onto the scenes a few seasons ago. What have you noticed when it comes to his attacking play?
Well, I think the interesting thing with Alexander Arnold is for a while he's been able to drift inside a little bit and act as a playmaker as much as just an overlapping fullback who gets crosses in. I remember doing an article about that. Must have been 2 years ago now. But I thought at the weekend they showed a bit of a variation where there seems to be more emphasis on him coming inside. And I think it's something that Liverpool like to do against narrow teams, because I remember them doing it quite effectively against Atletico Madrid in, I think, pretty much the last game that was played in front of fans before the first lockdown. Well, Liverpool actually lost that tie, or lost the second leg and lost on aggregate, but I thought they were the better team on the night. And in that game, it featured Oxlade-Chamberlain playing, in theory, as a right-sided central midfielder, but actually overlapping a lot towards the touchline and getting lots of crosses in. Oxlade-Chamberlain was unavailable the weekend for personal reasons, so Klopp used Harvey Elliott there. And my understanding of Harvey Elliott is really that he's kind of considered a winger rather than a central midfielder. And that's how he played. I mean, he drifted out wide. There was a lot of space out there because Burnley, you know, liked to keep a very narrow shape without possession. And that meant that not only could Salah come inside, I think Salah tends to just do his own thing. We know that he's always going to be cutting inside onto his left foot. But Alexander Arnold probably played narrower than I've ever seen him. And that was summed up really well by the excellent second goal that was rounded off by Mane, that featured Alexander Arnold's little flick around the corner to get the assist. But it was certainly a big part of the way Liverpool played, and I think something more deliberate and more extreme than what we've seen from Alexander Arnold beforehand.
It's funny you mentioned when it comes to the language of being a right back, Trent was neither particularly right nor was he particularly back. So would you say in sort of settled possession, his most frequent position that he was taking up was almost more of a sort of right-sided central midfield role with Elliott high and wide?
Yeah, definitely. He was always in that channel. And, you know, he's such a good deliverer of the ball that I think a lot of his best passes are almost like De Bruyne-esque passes. They're not necessarily crosses from a wide position. They're from a much narrower zone. Tom's done a great article in the past about, you know, the most dangerous positions to cross from. I don't know how he thinks Alexander Arnold's positioning fits into that.
Yeah, I think it was picked up by Peter Crouch actually on the kind of halfway point of the broadcast on Saturday, and I think it was saying that they're crossing a lot, but the positions weren't that dangerous, which was music to my ears certainly. And I think that definitely passed the eye test in terms of that really deep far position that Trent crossed a lot from. But I thought an interesting thing, well, a couple of interesting things from him and his crossing this weekend was the first was Liverpool had 3.2 options in the box on average. For each cross attempt, according to Opta, which is an interesting stat. I don't think it's one we've seen too much of before, and it's obviously leveraging the tracking data and knowing where all the players are on the pitch at any time. So that's a kind of new insight we'll see more of this season. And that's behind Man City in their first two games, who obviously, you know, love to pat the box for cutbacks and things like that. So I thought that was interesting. But also, and it's something that Michael picked out as well, Trent was also crossing a lot on his left. And not his right. So I think of his five crosses against Norwich, they were all kind of right-footed. And of his six against Burnley, I think three of them were with his left. And going through the clips, you see that as soon as he receives on his right, I think the Burnley defenders will come out to him quite aggressively, mainly Charlie Taylor, and try and close that angle down. And as soon as he's kind of opening his body up to kind of, you know, receive on his right and cross in with his left, the pressure isn't as much, as if Burnley are thinking he's not going to cross it in from here. And he was able to get a few more like kind of uncontested crosses, which aren't as dangerous. He doesn't connect with them as well. The curve on them isn't as good as with his right, but do you take a slightly weaker left-footed cross that won't get blocked versus a right-footed one that might, although is better? It's a trade-off.
It's just a tough cross though, isn't it? From an inside right channel with your left foot from deep. In order to actually get the flight and curl for it to be anything other than quite easy for a solid centre-back to defend and head clear, you really do have to be very precise, which as a right-footed player, not that Trent is poor on his left foot, that doesn't feel like the sort of efficient way to approach that.
Yeah, certainly. And I think that he was more aiming for the back stick where you had Virgil van Dijk or Joel Matip and kind of, you know, use them to nod it back across the goal versus, you know, the goal we saw from Diogo Jota, where he's kind of popping up from Tsimikas and flicking it on. That's not a header you'd be able to do with a cross like that. because you just don't have enough power on the ball to kind of redirect it. So, yeah, I don't think that's probably the optimal strategy in that situation, but Liverpool have so many possessions in the final third that you can roll the dice on a few like that. And also, you know, if Burnley half clear it, Liverpool counter press and build the attack from there, you know, that's how you can be more dangerous in the second phase, but you need to at least attempt something in the first phase to get to that in the first place.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. This is what we've got planned for you across the Athletic Podcast Network this season. The Ornstein and Chapman podcast has been rebranded as the Athletic Football Podcast. We'll release 4 episodes across the week as our journalists bring you the very best insight into the biggest stories in football and the business of sport. Michael Cox will continue to bring you the smartest analysis of all the big games in the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Adam Hurry will now host 2 episodes of the Football Clichés podcast every single week with his usual take on the game. There's a brand new Athletic FPL podcast with our fantasy football expert, the FPL General, giving you all the advice you need to stay ahead of your mates and top of the FPL rankings. And the Athletic Podcast Network is also home now to a host of club-specific shows, some of which are going to be releasing multiple episodes every week. And we're now your destination, don't forget, for the Totally Football Show with James Richardson and the Totally Football League Show. And that is it. We can't fit any more in. All you've got to do is search for The Athletic in your podcast provider of choice or go to our podcast section on the Athletic app. Not surprisingly, with all of the stuff that I've just mentioned, The Athletic is now the world's biggest football podcast network.
Michael, Kyle Walker, Manchester City's right back. I mean, he's been occupying space infield for quite some time. That's not anything new. Is there anything new that he's doing with the ball when he's occupying that space infield? Is there anything new that Pep is doing, within that?
Well, I suppose the notable thing here was that he played 2 brilliant passes, 3 together with Jesus for 2 Manchester City goals. Afterwards, Daniel Farke said that 4 of the 5 goals Norwich conceded were identical. Certainly those 2 were almost completely identical. And again, it's a position we're accustomed to Walker playing. He showed his versatility to play right-sided centre-back for England when needed. But I just don't think many other sides play those kind of in-to-out balls from a fullback to a winger. You just don't usually see those players positioned in those zones. Actually, one side who does do it quite often is actually Manchester City's women's side. I know there's a lot of link up in terms of the coaches between the men's and the women's side. I mean, Gareth Taylor, who's the Manchester City women's manager, was previously with the men's youth side. So they often talk about being cohesive and holistic and the rest of it. And I think you do see some similar patterns for the women's side. It's often Lucy Bronze playing it to Chloe Kelly or Greenwood to Hemp on the other side. So it does seem quite a specific Manchester City ball, I would say. Can't think of any other teams really who would get their players in those kind of positions to enable that pass.
Yeah, I think that, like you said, it was a pass that was executed a couple of times and they were near identical, really, like you said, Michael. But it's quite funny, I've never really had Kyle Walker down as that technically, you know, gifted a footballer. The reason he plays his role for England is because his strengths lie in his speed and not so his passing. We saw it in a couple of games where he's kind of making basic 10-15 yard passes and they're going out of play or straight to the opposition. But I think that was quite a pleasing thing to see, that, you know, you can't just be defined by the things that you do on the pitch are also certain things that players do rarely, but they also have, you know, the ability to pull off, such as those passes. But I think a lot of the value in those moves comes from the Gabriel Jesus run. That obviously the pass is nothing without the run, and I think it was we were talking about right backs here, obviously specifically, but I thought that was obviously a very well planned and trained coordinated move. But without the run, you don't get that the threat from that, and I thought that was something that City have got issues with strikes at the moment, lack of squad depth, and it's maybe we see. I think Sam Lee wrote a really nice piece about Jesus the winger from now on, which was fun. But yeah, going back to Walker, I guess I was just a bit surprised that he was the player executing that and not someone else, but he obviously can.
And not strictly talking about a right back from the weekend, Michael, but let's just touch on João Cancelo as well, Walker's teammate and, you know, more traditionally a right back, but certainly, as we've seen over the last 18 months, can just fulfil so many different roles for this Guardiola side. What have we seen from Cancelo so far this season?
Yeah, he's played on both sides, as he can do. I mean, I think if you're going to ask your fullback to drift inside into central midfield, it's probably less relevant which foot they're most comfortable with. You know, that's certainly not the case if they're overlapping down the outside, because generally you want someone on their natural crossing side. But yeah, he's a brilliant player, and he's a great passer as well. I mean, I actually prefer him to the right, because I think he can play those De Bruyne-esque balls or Alexander-Arnold-esque balls kind of curled in behind the opposition defence. Can do that to a certain extent from the left. But as you say earlier, if you're going with your other foot, I mean, he is right-footed, but if you're going with your right foot from the left, I think that is generally quite a difficult pass, the way he likes to float it over the top. But yeah, he can do a bit of everything. I mean, we haven't yet arrived at what I would say is teams playing inverted fullbacks, i.e. on the opposite sides to natural. You know, it's just the case that Cancelo is a very good option at left back and happens to be right-footed, and Kyle Walker's right-footed as well. But yeah, he's a great player, and maybe got a bit of a point to prove, Cancelo, because he was left out of the Champions League final side. Didn't have a great Euros with Portugal for reasons we mentioned earlier.
I just like the fact that every time you refer to that pass that De Bruyne makes, you've added a new name to it. So it was De Bruyne-esque when you talked about Trent, and then you said De Bruyne-esque or Alexander-Arnold-esque, and now next time you're going to have to say De Bruyne, Alexander-Arnold and João Cancelo-esque, which might raise some eyebrows, but we'll know what you mean about that.
It'd be like a memory game, you know, by the 9th or 10th it'll be your turn and you have to remember who I said is the fourth player in the list.
I went to the supermarket and I bought. Tom, let's stay towards the top of the Premier League table, because that's where Brighton are at the moment after two wins from two, and I genuinely can't really work out what they're doing on the right side of defence, so I want you to talk me through it, because I'm looking at Adam Webster's heat map and he looks like he's playing as a right wing back. I'm looking at Pascal Gross's heat map and he looks like he's playing as some sort of a right wing back. Who is their right back? What's been going on and why?
Yeah, I think injury issues have kind of forced them to use Pascal Gross their last game, and I think Gross started at left back against Burnley. I think we mentioned that on the pod last week, so yeah, they need some reinforcements there for sure. But as is the Graham Potter way, you could put, you know, anyone there and they'd probably still be able to do a job, just because the way that he's such a good coach. But yeah, Gross, we'll start with Gross first. I mean, he obviously is someone who excels with his delivery. He's a bit one-paced. He's not the quickest, doesn't really get around the pitch that well, but I think he's a decent passer of the ball. And yeah, he probably more pushes up on the right, and they kind of shift to a kind of three at the back with him there. But then Adam Webster is someone who he's kind of, you know, we lost Chris Basham because of relegation, but he's kind of taken his role and kind of that's the mould that he's playing. We see him kind of picking up balls from a throw-in at the weekend. I think Ken Sema switched off and Adam Webster just went on a driving run past two or three players, put a cross in, and he's just doing a lot of ball progression down that right hand side. And I think we bigged him up a little bit on this podcast before, and I think that he had his injury issues last year, but to lose Ben White and still have him behind him, and he's obviously a bit older, but he's arguably, you know, just as good technically with the ball at his feet, and he's happy to drive past people, it's not too much of a worry for Brighton to cash in on White for 50 million and have Adam Webster there. But yeah, Gross, I mean, I can't see that being his role for the whole season, especially when at some point Tariq Lamptey will come back from injury. But I think my favourite thing about him is every time you see him do a Cruyff turn, it completely sells the opposition defender. I've never seen a player consistently just spin a defender around with him doing it. And I think that he might be the best at it since the man who invented it himself.
Amazing. Maybe even better than Cruyff, you know?
Should be the gross turn, perhaps.
That great debate about how elite-level athletes have improved so much over the last 20, 30 years that maybe Pascal Gross is a better footballer than Johan Cruyff. We'll never know. We'll never be able to measure that. Surely, Tom, this is one of the best value signings that we've seen in the Premier League over the last 5 years. What he's done for Brighton and the fact that I think the gross amount was about £3 million.
Yeah, horrible. Yeah, £3.5 million, which, yeah, like you say, is ridiculous money, really. Very, very good to get just the sheer number of minutes, assists, chance creation, whatever it is, from someone consistently across multiple managers as well, I think is really important. So, yeah, very, very good value. And I guess it's what we've come to expect a little bit from Brighton. So we talk about their recruitment a lot on this podcast. And, yeah, he's a good example why.
If you're interested in the net amount, Ali, he's scored 16 Premier League goals in that time.
Well,
really good.
Do you know what? The big question when it comes to this debate about set piece coaches, the one thing that we all want to know that gets referred to a lot is what is the value of a Premier League goal? And Michael, you can tell me what that means for Pascal Gross.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Tom, let's talk about Matty Cash. Let's talk about his long throws and Villa scoring from a long throw and Villa having a set-piece coach and Danny Murphy getting very upset about that fact. The whole debate stems around the value added by someone whose mere presence over 9 months could increase the amount of goals scored by your team by between 1 and 10 goals and the value of each goal in the Premier League, which, you know, in analytical terms, people can put a pretty good number on it, right?
I think the figure that I saw knocking around Twitter the other day was £1 million per goal around. So if you can add one goal, just one more goal a year, it's worth £1 million, and you're a coach getting paid a lot less than that. I just can't see where it doesn't get to a point where coaching staff and analysts just earn a lot more money than they're on now when their value is realised. You know, the marginal difference between two analysts might be negligible, but equally they both add a lot, especially the good ones, to a side's ability to create and score. So, I'm not saying all coaches should go to the director of football's office and ask for a raise, but I guess I'm kind of saying that.
And also, like, I mean, you can compare it to the cost of a goal, which I think sometimes is, even when we're told that it's £1 million a goal, it's still slightly difficult to get our heads around. But you can very easily compare it to the cost of a backup left-back salary. You know, and some of these players will play maybe 2 Premier League games all season. So if you've got a set-piece coach who can get you just 3 or 4 extra goals, in terms of value for money, it's great. I say just sack all the players and just have an entire staff of set-piece analysts. I think that's the way to go.
Tom, specifically in the piece that you wrote, you used the example of Eric Ramsey, who is a summer signing for Manchester United from Chelsea. It was only 2.5 years ago that he was working for Shrewsbury Town. So his own rise within the coaching sphere has been meteoric. And you were looking not necessarily at what he's done initially in the first 2 games of the season, but looking more generally at Manchester United, where their goals have come from over the last few seasons. specifically when it comes to penalties, how likely they are to continue receiving and scoring 10 to 15 penalties per season, and then comparing that with their set piece output, which doesn't compare particularly well to other teams of their size.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they've scored 29 penalties in the last three seasons, which is a few ahead of Leicester, but it's a lot of penalties to be kind of winning and dispatching in that time. And there's obviously the Bruno Fernandes effect. There's, you know, obviously I think VAR has probably given them a couple that in the new Titan rules maybe aren't given. So if you're saying that's going to drop to, say, five, how do you make up those goals? Because scoring goals from open play is difficult. They've not really got any more creative in open play. They maybe will with Jadon Sancho when he starts playing more, but you're always going to have a similar-ish number of free kicks and corners and throw-ins throughout each season. And if you can just make those 1% better, you're going to get at least one more goal from that. So it just makes complete sense to have someone who's tasked with squeezing, or at least just like paying some attention to that. And I think a lot of clubs still will get to, you know, the last session on Friday, 50 minutes, right, lads, let's do set pieces now. And they're just not really given much care and attention. And I think that, you know, there was something written by Ted Knutsen, who is the kind of founder and CEO of StatsBomb and worked with FC Midtjylland and Brentford for a while. And he's worked on set pieces and set piece consultancy. And this whole piece that when he was in Denmark at Midtjylland, they focused a lot on set pieces. And I think they increased the number of set piece goals by about one more every five games. So, you know, 2.2 goals per game. And that's a lot. And that's something that kind of remained 3 years after that point to where the whole league was scoring more goals. And I think Ted was kind of saying in this piece from a few years ago that it's not that it's a trade-off between open play goals and set play goals. Like, you can raise the level of scoring by everyone being better at set pieces. And I think that for clubs is surely just a no-brainer of let's just all you know, focus on set pieces a lot more. They're a free-ish source of goals, value for money-wise. And Matt Couch is one perfect example. Just come back to him in Aston Villa, where you've got someone who at Nottingham Forest consistently uses long throw to attack and to create threat. Moved to Villa, didn't really use it at all. They didn't really have any routines, even though they had, you know, Samatta and Wesley, who are okay in the air. But you know, you can create whole routines where you're doing what you do at the weekend, where you bring Tyrone Mings as kind of the focal point. He flicks on, Danny Ings finishes emphatically, but without that little bit of practice and, you know, using the throw, having a run, all these kind of small things at the set piece, that wouldn't happen without the set piece coach. So it just feels like a no-brainer, but football's slow to change and to learn these things. But maybe now, as I was kind of trying to say in the piece, we're slowly realizing, okay, this is a good value area, let's actually try and make the most of it.
Interesting your comparison with what happened in Denmark a few years ago. I wonder what the price of a goal is in Denmark, or the value of a goal. What's the exchange rate? That'd be good to work out. What I would like to know, Tom, just quickly on this, is with the increase in set piece coaches in the Premier League, and as you say, there are plenty that haven't adopted that yet, should we expect the proportion of goals scored from set pieces to rise, or just goal numbers in general to rise as teams improve on this front?
Yeah, I think the latter in the long run, really. I don't really see how, I mean, if a team gets too focused on set pieces and winning more set pieces, then yeah, maybe there's fewer opportunities to score from open play and you're not going to score as many. But I think in the long run, you know, all things being equal, you will just see more goals from set pieces and more goals overall. And not that every team's going to try and be playing four set pieces a la Stoke, a la, you know, sides that, you know, Cardiff in the Championship at the moment, who I think have scored all nine goals. Ali, there was a stat from your podcast the other day, all nine goals so far are headed goals, which is fantastic. So yeah, I don't think we'll go to that point in the Premier League because the technical players are too good to waste them on just lobbing long throws at their heads. But yeah, one to keep an eye on. I don't think we'll have answers in the short term, but we can revisit this in a year's time and see if I was right or not.
Okie doke. Well, pray for the backup left backs, because it's going to be a tough few years for them, I think, from the sounds of things. Look, let's rattle through a couple more examples of right-sided fullbacks or wingbacks in the Premier League. I want to bring up West Ham's Tufal, the right back, because I want to know if he is, you know, when we talk about the evolution of fullbacks, the development tactically of the modern game, is what Tufal is asked to do for David Moyes' West Ham, Michael, the most traditional fullback of all fullbacks in the Premier League at the moment?
Yeah, I think you're right. He probably is. When he first came over, I thought he was primarily just a good, solid defender. But actually, I was a little bit wrong. He was, you know, increasingly effective as the season went on going forward. I think a good thing about him is he's a good crosser, but he just times his runs very well. He, you know, he arrives quite late on the overlap. And I always think that's a really underrated thing as a fullback. If you're a wing back, you know, playing in a Chelsea system, you've kind of got to be high up the pitch and constantly providing that outlet high up. But if you're fullback and you've got the timing of the runs to, you know, often you're playing against a winger who doesn't really want to be tracking back. And if he just switches off for 2 seconds and you go, that can be so effective. And he's really good at that. And West Ham have got, you know, it goes back to what we said earlier about Moyes and how throughout his career, he's always been about, you know, his team's progressing the ball down the flanks, getting in crosses, getting in cutbacks. And West Ham have got a lot of players who are very good in those kind of situations. We know about Suchek and his late runs. Mikel Antonio, of course, very topically good at converting crosses. Fornals, his finish for the, I think it was the second goal that West Ham scored on Monday night. Or was it the opener, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a brilliant finish. Fornals is a good little player. I like the way he gets in pockets on the edge of the box as well. So it does seem to work well with, you know, a side that maybe don't have a real standout attacking talent, but a lot of players who are good at attacking crosses from wide.
Tom Tuchel continues to impress. He strikes me as the kind of guy who probably has benefited from underlying numbers and analytics being, you know, more widely used in the game, because the eye test for Tuchel is solid defender. Pretty much think you know what you're getting from him. But I feel like the underlying numbers for Tuchel actually bump him up a level. They just show what a clever player he is, and ultimately how much of a positive impact he has on West Ham when he plays, which is ultimately what you're after.
Absolutely. I mean, he's not one who I think obviously generates too much in terms of expected goals or expected assists, but I mean, looking at expected threat, which we've mentioned a couple of times in this podcast now, which is a kind of newish metric which looks at players who progress the ball into dangerous areas. He shows it really favourably through his passing, through his carrying of the ball upfield, and I think he retains the ball, not amazingly, but I think there are some kind of high value passes in there where he's kind of sliding through a runner or kind of able to carry the ball upfield and then retain it, and he's moved the team further into the attacking third. So yeah, there's things like that which I don't think he's been signed from Slavia Prague for his ability to do that. From the numbers point of view, it's probably David Moyes has seen similar things and thought, okay, that, you know, he will fit my system perfectly. And yeah, he's just been an extremely solid signing, and I'm kind of surprised that he's not been linked to anyone. I mean, age-wise, in the Premier League, with most teams trying and thinking, okay, under 25 is our preferred market. He's probably a little bit outside that, but he's just looked really solid. Played a lot, always is kind of that consistent 7 out of 10. And yeah, I mean, I have to say, I really enjoy watching West Ham. I think they might be one of my favourite teams to watch in the Premier League at the moment.
Oh, you didn't even know I was going to do this, but that set me up really nicely. I don't know if you saw, I did a little thought experiment on Twitter the other day, because I really enjoyed watching Brighton the other day, and it struck me how often I enjoy watching Brighton matches when I watch Brighton matches. Not just for what they do, I just feel like the way that they play generally makes for a good match. And at Premier League level, you know, that's not always the case. So I asked my Twitter followers if they could only watch 3 teams in the Premier League this season. They weren't allowed to watch any other matches, but they could watch every game for 3 of the 20 teams, who they would choose. And the top 3 responses, interestingly, were Leeds United, Brighton and Hove Albion, and Chelsea. Now, I'm sure there's a little bit of sort of recency bias with a few of those, but I think in general, Bielsa, Potter, Tuchel, those would probably be my 3 picks as well, which just reflects what a terrible echo chamber I'm living in online. but I thought that was quite interesting, and maybe not necessarily what people expected. I should say that the next most picked team was West Ham in 4th out of 20, which was certainly a surprise to me. But Michael, maybe I'm missing something when it comes to West Ham. I know they've had some high scoring games so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right on the recency bias. I thought the Monday night game was not just the performance, but the atmosphere as well was great. And I don't think I've ever said that about an atmosphere at the London Stadium before. So yeah, it does feel like they've got their tails up. And I think they'll slightly struggle to sustain last season's form. But I agree. I mean, it's created a really, really good unit there. And I think they're good in those games, aren't they? They're good against teams who want to come onto them and they can break and get crosses in. So, yeah, I like watching them as well.
Fifth highest selected team were Brentford, the newbies. Again, echo chamber stuff for me, this. It was, I sort of quite enjoying the experiment, and then it actually left me really considering my whole existence and how I live and act online. Tom, who would your three be?
On the spot now. I think West Ham are in there because I'm enjoying them at the moment. I do always enjoy Liverpool games as well, I think, and probably Brighton as well, just to see the way that Graham Potter tries to change things and tweak them and kind of get himself out of certain situations. But no, to be fair, it won't be Liverpool, it's got to be Leeds. I just think they're great entertainment anytime they play. And I was chatting about it in the office yesterday and chatting to Adam Crafton, one of our writers, and we both kind of agreeing that Leeds games should just be on free-to-air TV. Like, everyone should be able to enjoy. It should be like a public good that you should be able to enjoy Leeds United in the Premier League under Marcelo Bielsa.
He would certainly approve of that, I'm sure. Michael, 17 of the 20 teams were mentioned, which is a nice spread, but no one said Watford, no one said Burnley, and no one said Norwich, which I thought was a bit of a shame.
Who said Newcastle? Can I have their username, please? I want to ask some questions. No, I'm joking. I think Newcastle are quite fun to watch. Yeah, that does tally. I mean, I quite like watching games when there's a real contrast. So, for example, this weekend coming up, we got Burnley against Leeds. And I would not choose to watch Burnley every week. But just games like that, I think, are the most interesting because they're just two teams trying to do completely different things. Just Dyche against Bielsa, for me, is more interesting than probably than Bielsa against Klopp or something like that. Just, you know, the tactical variety is always interesting to me. And obviously we focus on teams that are progressive and innovative and evolving the game, understandably so. But it's often now, because there aren't that many old school managers in the Premier League, Dyche is the most tactically distinct. So I think Burnley's matches against teams are often very interesting.
It was actually Rich, who's a Hull City fan, who said Newcastle. And he said, just to try and understand why they keep playing the way they do. So there's your answer. Especially good, because we also had Jamie McGovern, who said, finally, an excuse not to watch Newcastle. And then picks Chelsea, Leeds and West Ham. Clearly a bit fed up of watching his side, I think it's fair to say. Let's finish up just touching on a couple more right-backs in the Premier League. I want to know if there's anything notable on Aaron Wan-Bissaka and the right-back for Spurs in the first two games, Jaffet Tanganga. Michael, the development of those two, the roles that they play, anything on that note from you?
Yeah, the more defensive end of things, aren't they? I would think Tanganga, if he's got a future as a top player for Tottenham, would probably be as a centre-back. Wan-Bissaka, I think we all know that he went to Manchester United relatively early in his career. He'd been playing for a fairly defensive-minded Crystal Palace side. I think switching from the demands of playing in a Roy Hodgson back four to playing a lot of games where you're expected to overlap and get crosses in, it was very difficult. I think he's made decent progress in terms of crossing. Maybe he's not great at passing, actually, on the ball. I think, you know, I've always thought he would make a good right-sided centre-back. But usually when Manchester United have played that way, it's been Luke Shaw who's tucked inside to play that role. And now that Manchester United have Maguire, Varane and Lindelof, you think probably they will be the back three if Solskjaer wants to play that way. So yeah, I'm not sure what the future is for Wan-Bissaka. Certainly there was a lot of talk about Kieran Trippier coming in, who would be a very different option, more of a crosser, an overlapper. And that would be a nice balance to have. It would be nice to have those two options. But I quite like Wan-Bissaka. I think the balance with him on one flank and Shaw on the other, who's had a great year or so, both for Manchester United and England, I think is basically fine.
Tom, Wan-Bissaka's skill set seems perfect, especially with Shaw on the other side, for one of your favourite asymmetrical fullback roles.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's why I think Michael's kind of hit the nail on the head there, that him as a right-sided centre-back would make most sense. Just to kind of pinch him inside a little bit and shuffle around and kind of have five attackers across the front. But that's, I guess, not really how United attack so far under Solskjaer. But just to touch on Jaffet Tanganga's performances a little bit, I think that he obviously did extremely well to, you know, not get sent off really against Raheem Sterling and Jack Grealish on the opening day. And then I just think he's a very, it's kind of clear he's kind of a more centre-back profile or slightly more mobile centre back who's playing out wide. I don't think he's got too much on the ball. I don't think he's not a carrier. He's not a crosser. So he's fairly limited in an attacking sense. But I think probably for Nuno's Spurs, what he's being asked to do as a kind of stopper at the back makes sense. And I think that's probably going to be his position this season. And then how do you build those other elements of his game in terms of, you know, with the ball at his feet so that he can start for Spurs at some point? I think that's the bigger question mark about his long-term development. But in terms of the roles that we see different right-backs play, his is fairly unique. And I guess, I don't know, for me at least, it feels like a little bit of the more old school, the kind of Gary Neville about him. It's kind of defending first. If you go over the halfway line, you might get a nosebleed kind of approach to playing the position.
And Tom, last but not least, the newest member of the Premier League right-back club, Tino Livramento, who has started both games for Southampton, having joined from Chelsea in the summer. Exceptionally young footballer to be starting Premier League games and an impressive start. I was hoping you could maybe give us a little scout report on Livramento and how he's coped early on.
Yeah, I think he's coped really well. He's absolutely rapid, both over kind of short distances, long distances, likes to take players on. I think he looks really comfy with the ball at his feet, a bit erratic at times in the final third, but then again, that's kind of how Southampton do play at times. And that was a good stat. I mean, we don't usually read too much into single game stats, but I think it obviously shows that he read the game well against Manchester United, where he got 6 interceptions. And at the age of, 18 years and 283 days, he's the youngest player to make as many interceptions as that in a single match since Luke Shaw against Reading in December of 2012. So nice kind of, you know, that's the route. I mean, that was the stop word, the end word that Opta used on that tweet, and that very much shows kind of, you know, if Shaw can do it for Southampton and Livramento can, then that's kind of the progress which you might see. But I think he won man of the match against Manchester United. I think you win man of the match, you're nominated for it or whatever. He was man of the match in that case. I've just been really impressed, and I think that it's interesting to see that, just a wider point about Southampton's business in general this season, that they've become a bit of a kind of, I guess, a bit of a kind of Dortmund D Leipzig-y kind of model, where you've got Adam Armstrong, who's kind of, you know, relatively low cost in the Premier League, not that level, but has come in and obviously is a fit and works really well. Roman Perreault, who's come from Stade Brest in France for around 11 million. And then the rest, apart from Theo Walcott on a free transfer, you've got three guys from Chelsea's under-23s who aren't going to get games in Dinel Semiu, Armando Broca, who we mentioned in the past, and Livramento himself. And, you know, they're all probably pretty low-cost, high-value players who could, after one season, double, triple their value. And if Ralf Hasenhüttl has the trust in them to play them, then that's, you know, all the more benefit for their development. So really interesting change in approach, I guess, from Southampton this year. Maybe, you know, COVID and lack of finances means it's forced, but equally you still have to execute that. And I think so far they have done, and Livramento looks like a really, really good pickup for, around £5 million so far this summer.
Certainly a player and a team that we will be keeping a close eye on over the next few months. I've really enjoyed that. I'm really pleased that a couple of right-backs caught Michael's eye over the weekend, because I think we've developed that into a really interesting episode, and you guys have raised some really interesting points about what is a right-back these days at the very top level. Hopefully you listening have enjoyed this as well. Now, if I get my way, I think we could build this episode into an ongoing series looking at the roles within the position. And if you like that idea, please do let us know if you'd like to hear more like this. And also, why not let me know which position you'd like us to look at next? That's something that we'll look at over the next few weeks and months as we continue to try and offer something a little bit different in the football podcasting sphere here on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast feed, all the other excellent Athletic football podcast offerings, and do sign up to The Athletic today if you haven't got a subscription. That will allow you to read everything that Michael and Tom write, and so much more as well. theathletic.com/tactics is where you should go to find out the latest offer on your annual subscription and move forward with The Athletic in your hearts and minds. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week, and we look forward to it on The Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.